afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time and taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible, about Christianity, about the your spiritual life, any of those things, we can talk about those. You can raise those topics here. If you have a difference of opinion from the host and would like to discuss that and bring balance, feel free to do that as well, which is what I expect our first caller today is calling to do. And you can reach me here later in the program. Our lines are full now, so you can't reach me right this minute, but you can reach me here during the program at 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller is Bruce from Beaverton, Oregon, and I believe Bruce is probably calling to follow up on a conversation we ran out of time for yesterday. Am I right, Bruce?
Oh, Steve, no, this is a different Bruce.
Different Bruce, oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm glad to say I'm not the same Bruce.
Okay, yeah, I assumed okay. It was the same Bruce, but we got a different Bruce. Because I did tell him to call up early this program if you wanted to finish the conversation, but
yeah,
I guess he didn't get in yet.
I'm from a different place.
Different Bruce,
anyway,
okay.
Here's the issue is Isaiah.
Okay.
And you may know that Bible Study Fellowship added Isaiah to their repertoire, and they've been covering it this year. At any rate, spent the year studying it, and there is. I want your take. I want your insight. This debate about is it possible that Isaiah was really written by one person as opposed to, you know, there's a lot of
two or three. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I guess I'm going to have to go back and reread it again because. I just need some edification. But here's what I want to lead off with, and then you take it. Linguistically, historically, style, all these things. You know, I'm seeing some differences, and just take the suffering servant for example. You see it, and it's so prominent and so wonderful, of course. In that middle section, and then you get to the last, you know, chapters 56 to 66, it just totally disappears. And you get, you know, I sense a sort of a different emphasis in the end, where there's, you know, instead of the I thou kind of thinking going on, it's more focused on cultic practices. And you know, if I go and read Ezra, wow, you know, after the return from Babylon, they've got problems again. Do you know what I'm saying? And I read that in the end of Isaiah even. So give me your best thoughts on this.
Well, okay, for many of our listeners may not know, the single authorship of the book of Isaiah has been a major controversy, at least since the 19th century. Among Christians, there are those that we would sometimes call liberal Christians, and there are those who are called conservative Christians, and they have different views on this. The conservative Christians usually affirm that there is one author to the whole book of Isaiah. Whereas liberal Christians and those who are perhaps of a little more liberal stripe, but wouldn't call themselves liberal, think they see at least two authors of Isaiah. There's a significant difference between the subject matter and other matters in between the first 39 chapters on the one hand and the last 27 chapters. So there's chapters 1 through 39. And then there's chapters 40 through 66, and the difference between these is significant. For one thing, in the first part of this, the threat to Israel is the Assyrian threat, whereas in chapters 40 through 66, the enemy appears to be Babylon, which was a reflective of a later period in Israel's history. The first 39 chapters often mention Isaiah by name, as the author and as a character in them, whereas the last 27 chapters don't mention Isaiah by name, either as an author or in any other way. There are different themes handled in the last 27 chapters that are not handled so much in the first 39 chapters and so forth. And there are enough differences that many people have thought the last 27 chapters must have been written by somebody else, not the least of which is that they mention by name a man named Cyrus, who was the Persian leader who conquered Babylon and released the children of Israel. And he is mentioned by name a few times in the latter part of Isaiah. But he lived, 100 years after Isaiah the prophet. And therefore, it is suggested that these references to Cyrus and what he would do and so forth reflect a later authorship, because Isaiah wrote 100 years before Cyrus was even born, 150 years, I think. And so these are the concerns that people have expressed. Now, conservatives who affirm that there is only one author of the whole book of Isaiah point to the fact that Jesus and the apostles quote from both sections and always refer to them as Isaiah. Sometimes they even say the prophet Isaiah wrote. So that there's the early Christians did not acknowledge that one portion, the early portion, was written by Isaiah and another portion was written by somebody else. They took the book as one document. Even the Dead Sea Scrolls seem to see it that way, because in the Isaiah scrolls that were found, and they date from the time of Christ, but they're not put out by Christians, they're put out by Jewish people from the Essene community. The Dead Sea Scrolls in the Isaiah scroll, chapter 39 ends almost at the bottom of a leaf, at the end of a page. And it would be a natural place to just divide it if they thought that chapter 40 began another book. But they put the first line of chapter 40 at the bottom, just under chapter 39, and continued on as if they didn't see any break there. In other words, 2,000 years ago, the Jews did not see any reason to believe there were two separate books here by different authors. And so there's these considerations. Now, one thing is that there's a lot of themes that are the same in both sections. For example, the reference to the nation being sick and needing a physician are found in the early part and the later part. References to all the Gentile nations flowing into God's holy mountain are in both parts. Many references to a highway in the wilderness being formed are found in both sections. The reference to the wolf and the lamb and the lion eating straw and so forth, they are found in both sections, chapter 11 and chapter 65. Reference to the Messiah being a banner to the nations and the nations coming to drawing to that banner, that's found in both sections. And there are many others. Also, the expression, the Holy One of Israel, is a common phrase in Isaiah, but not elsewhere in Scripture. For example, outside of Isaiah, the term the Holy One of Israel, as a term for God, is used only 5 times in the entire Old Testament. But in Isaiah, it is used 26 times, 12 times in the first 39 chapters, and 14 times in the last 27 chapters. In other words, a very distinctly Isaianic expression for God is found, in both sections quite frequently, but not frequently anywhere else in the Old Testament. Now, those don't prove a single authorship, but they kind of point that direction. But what do we do then with the fact that the last 27 chapters speak about the Jews being released from Babylon, a much later time than Isaiah's time? And they speak about it as if it's accomplished already, or they speak of it in the past tense. They speak of Cyrus and all that. Well, as I understand it, the prophets often spoke of future things in the what we call the prophetic perfect tense. They speak in the past tense because they are carried forward in vision to a later time, and they describe something as they are seeing it, and they say, I saw this, and it was this way, and this was happening, and this was happening. They're talking in the past tense as they're describing what they saw in many cases, but they're really, of course, transported by the Spirit to a future time. And I think that's the way that most conservatives would see it, especially leaning heavily on the fact that Jesus and the apostles quote from both sections of Isaiah and frequently refer both of them to Isaiah as the author. Mm-hmm. Then there's another important thing, too, and that is the last 27 chapters of Isaiah are some of the finest literature in the entire Bible. I mean, this is something that many scholars, both Christian, Jewish, and non-believers, have observed. As far as literary quality, whoever wrote the last 27 chapters of Isaiah was one of the finest poets known to man. And if that was not Isaiah, as it has generally been believed by the Jews that it was and by Christians, that means that one of the most superior writers of all time, his writings have been preserved, but his name is unknown, and he accidentally had his writings attached to another man named Isaiah, so that these fine writings remain entirely anonymous, even though prophets that were much less significant in the things they wrote, like Obadiah and Nahum, for example, are remembered by name from what they wrote. Much less significant books by less significant prophets. Their books are retained and their names are attached to them. But if this man was not Isaiah, who wrote the chapters 27, well, I should say the last 27 chapters from 40 through 66, then one of the finest prophets and writers of all Israel's history, his works were somehow preserved, but no one cared to remember his name. And it would seem that the people who received the writings from his hand would know who he was.
And any researcher that would indicate there was a contemporary great writer of that stature? I mean,
In the time of Cyrus, you mean?
Yeah, I guess that would be the logical question. I mean,
well, we don't have any.
Great writers. I mean,
I'm sure they did, and Israel had some prophets at that time. Or at least they had Daniel, and Ezra was writing at that time.
Right.
Nehemiah was writing at that time, but
not of the same stature in terms of
no.
literature. I guess is what you're saying, Steve.
No, that's true. Yeah, their literary stature was not as impressive. Now, of course, literary. Stature is not the most important thing, but when a piece of literature survives and is retained for hundreds of years by those who admire it, but the author's name is simply not remembered, that's a very strange thing. But if it is in fact an integral part of the book of Isaiah, as it appears to be, it appears to be in all the manuscripts, it appears to be in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it was in the thinking of the Jews, and apparently even in the thinking of Jesus and the apostles, then that would explain why we don't have the name of another author there, because there wasn't another author.
And I guess, there's obviously Isaiah's life. I mean, this is his life. I guess he could have matured over time, in terms of his poetic ability, or his writing probably changed over time, I would assume.
Well, that's entirely possible. Although there's some fine poetic work in the early section, too. I mean, chapter 11, chapter 2, there's some excellent poetic work there.
How do you deal with the suffering servant is such a strong it's such a great section.
The servant of Yahweh is a character that appears in some of the chapters in the latter part of Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
And actually there are four sections that are usually called the servant songs. The scholars call them that, the servant songs. And they contain these oracles written as poems about the servant of Yahweh. And, of course, the servant of Yahweh is variously seen in them as Israel the nation and as the Messiah, as the ultimate representative of Israel the nation. But they are restricted to a few songs. But that doesn't surprise me. Isaiah's ministry continued for apparently about 50 years. And so he might well have written four songs about the servant of Yahweh at some point in his career and wrote on other subjects at other times.
Where do you come out on this?
I believe in a single authorship of Isaiah.
Yeah, I kind of sense that because as usual, you've just given a depth of analysis here and information I was unaware of, especially the thing about Dead Sea Scrolls. That's interesting.
That is interesting, yeah.
Last thing, and then I'll get off, and that is there's so much emphasis when you read Isaiah with a conservative lens, as BSF does, on this is Christ. This is the Messiah, and again, looking at the books of Moses, I know that foreshadowing and it's wonderful and so forth, but at times I think we sort of there's a danger of putting almost too much emphasis on that and not putting ourselves in the place of where Isaiah was. And you know, I come away almost not so impressed that Isaiah knew that Christ was coming. He knew, you know, the Lord was showing him an image, a vision. I'm impressed at how well Christ knew Isaiah, you know, in a way that there's that connection. But do you follow what I'm saying, that we can read too much into?
Well, there are many references in the Old Testament to the Messiah, which might not have been recognized as a reference to the Messiah, except perhaps by hindsight, mm-hmm. by someone who, you know, accepts the proposition that Jesus is the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
As, you know, if somebody accepts that Jesus is the Messiah, they can look back and see many things in the Old Testament
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, that was talking about to him because that's what he did.
Mm-hmm.
But where in Isaiah's time, they might not have seen all of those passages as being about the Messiah.
Yes,
and
the fulfillment, right? I mean,
right. The New Testament provides a fulfillment, a record of fulfillment
mm-hmm.
that sheds light on the meaning of what were otherwise obscure statements. And that's true not only about the Messiah, but about many prophecies about
mm-hmm.
you know, things about the nature of the Gentiles coming in and so forth.
Yeah.
But you know, I will say this much, that before Christ came, Isaiah 53, for example, the most famous chapter about the Messiah, although many Jews today, probably most Jews today, would say that's not talking about the Messiah. That's talking about Israel as the servant of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
That suffering servant is Israel, not the Messiah. Well, they may say that now, but it was a current Jewish belief in the time of Christ that Isaiah 53 was talking about the Messiah. I mean, the rabbis had,
mm-hmm.
to a large extent, adopted that idea. Now, not everyone had the same view about it. And remember, the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8 was reading Isaiah 53, and he asked Philip, well, who is this guy, who is this talking about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is a prophet talking about himself or someone else? And
mm-hmm.
and as a Christian who was informed by the facts of what had happened in the life of Christ, Philip knew instantly that that was about Jesus and explained that.
I respect, you know, the Jews at Christ's time. They certainly had a lot of knowledge about their Bible, right? And it sort of surprises me a little bit. We keep hearing how, oh, the Pharisees and Judas, you know, they were looking for some kind of warrior and on, right? You know, and gosh, when you read the book of Isaiah or other prophets, what they were being foretold was more like Christ than some kind of, you know, warrior that will beat the Romans.
Well, it was very common. It was very common in those days among the rabbis to believe there were two messiahs coming, a suffering one and a victorious one.
Mm.
Some of the rabbis referred to the suffering messiah as Messiah ben Joseph, and they referred to the victorious messiah as Messiah ben David. And they actually thought there would have to be two different men, one to be the sufferer described in those passages about the suffering of the messiah, and one to be the victorious one. You know, the rabbis didn't all have one opinion about things, but that was a very common suggestion.
Do they still believe that way?
I don't think so, but I don't know. I mean, again, wherever you get three Jews in a room, you got four opinions. And so it's really hard to say what, you know, all the rabbis would say today. They have different opinions, as they did back then.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Steve. I'll let you get going. Excellent comments. I appreciate it.
All right, Bruce. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Okay, we're going to talk next to Adam from Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome, Adam. Good to hear from you again.
Hi, thanks. Thanks so much, Steve. Different topic today. I was wondering, in Revelation chapter 11, the two witnesses who prophesy for 1,260 days have the power to destroy any man that opposes them, cause drought during their ministry, turn water into blood, strike the earth with every kind of plague, and are eventually going to be killed and then raised to life and ascend into heaven in the presence of their enemies. I'm not familiar with any commentary you might have given on that, and I don't know if it's too lengthy to go into here in a radio program. If it is, maybe you could just point me to a good resource that I could look at on the net or something.
Well, you might not have heard me mention my views on Revelation in general, that I'm not a futurist in my approach. Are you familiar with the different views of Revelation, the futurist and the preterist and the idealist and the historicist, or are those unfamiliar to you?
Yes, I am familiar.
Okay, well, the futurists, which is not what I am, futurists generally believe there will be two actual men that will come on the scene in Jerusalem in the end times, in the tribulation period, and that these things that are described of them in chapter 11 will literally happen, or at least fairly literally. They will prophesy for 3.5 years. They'll be killed by the beast. They will, their dead bodies will lie in the streets. For 3.5 days, they'll rise from the dead and ascend into heaven as everyone looks on. And so the futurist often tries to identify who these two witnesses will be. Usually the suggestion is that they are Elijah and Moses. Some think it'll be Elijah and Enoch. And there are a few other opinions, but those two I just mentioned are the main ones. Now, I don't hold the futurist view. I don't think the two witnesses are a reference to two actual individuals who will come in the last days. I believe Revelation is talking about something else, and I believe it's using very symbolic language. I believe that the symbols in Revelation are much more dislodged from the literalness with which we tend to take things in our Western civilization. Than we are often comfortable with. My own opinion, in a nutshell, is that the two witnesses represent the church. The fact that they have miracles associated with them, like those of Elijah, who shut up the heavens for 3.5 years, and who called fire down out of heaven out of his enemies, and like those of Moses, who could turn water into blood and smite the earth with plagues, this suggests that the authority that had been in Old Testament times invested in Moses and Elijah, or the law and the prophets, is now, that supernatural attestation now rests upon the church, who are like who are symbolically referred to as two witnesses. Now, why two? There are some who accept the two witnesses as representing the church, but they say, well, the reason there's two is because one is the Jewish church and one's the Gentile church, or the Jew and the Gentile in the church, or something like that. But I personally think that the number two, when it comes to witnesses, is a necessary number to confirm the truthfulness of their testimony. Because in the law, it says, in the mouth of two or more witnesses, every word shall be established. Or in the testimony of two is true, as Jesus quoted it. And so that the church's witness is reliable is indicated, to the Jewish mind at least, by the fact that it is like two witnesses. Not that there really are two churches or two parts of the church necessarily that are implied, but rather the truthfulness of the church witness is implied by the by there being two witnesses. The death of the witnesses I take to be a reference to something that may yet be future, and that the time may come when Satan, in a last hurrah of persecution against the church, manages to seemingly silence the church and drive it underground through persecution. But they're standing to their feet and ascending into heaven, I take to be the rapture of the church. So my own thought is that the two witnesses represent the church during the entirety of this age. And they actually do. It does contain some future aspects of what will happen to the church in the end. Now, that's only one of many, many views out there. And if you would listen to my lectures on Revelation, my verse-by-verse lectures, you'd hear all my arguments for that view. Right now, I'm just telling you what I believe. I'm not telling you why. So there are a lot of different views. Are you familiar with my book, Revelation Four Views, a Parallel Commentary?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, there's that book, you know, presents a variety of views side by side, examining what each of the four views say about each passage in Revelation.
Okay, yeah, I look forward to looking into that. Real quick, before I get off the phone here, what do you believe is the great city that symbolically is called Sodom and Egypt?
I believe it's Jerusalem, because it says, where also our Lord was crucified, there in verse 8. So
how would that tie into the church? If it says that their bodies were killed there.
Yeah, I believe that the great city is Jerusalem, but I don't have the ability right now to go into all of the cross references that would make sense of it for you from my point of view. And it's not, to tell you the truth, it's not even my hope to convince anybody of my view. When people ask my view, I don't mind telling it. But to give the defense of it and so forth is so time-consuming. I'd rather, you know, someone maybe listen to my lectures on that and see if they can get something, the validity of it, test the validity of it from there.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Okay, Adam. Thanks for your call.
God bless. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye now. Okay, let's talk next to Alec from Salinas, California. Hi, Alec. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. I heard someone say that if Adam and Eve had not eaten of the forbidden fruit, they would not have had children. I just wanted to get your take on that.
Well, who said that, and on what basis did they affirm it?
It was actually a Jehovah's Witness, but I don't think it had anything to do with their theology. But it was Genesis 3:7. When it says their eyes were opened and they knew that they were naked.
Yeah.
I guess the implication was that they were innocent, and that as soon as they ate of the fruit, they lost their innocence and became aware.
Well, no doubt they did lose their innocence, but what does that have to do with having children? There's nothing about having children that's not innocent.
I guess the part where it says they covered themselves.
Yeah.
Is that they immediately became aware of that they were naked.
I don't think that has anything to do with them having children. I think what that has to do is it describes the psychological change that came upon them when they realized and had a sense for the first time of the sensation of guilt. When people sense no guilt in each other's presence because they're not guilty of anything, they're quite transparent and unprotective. They'll say, you know, they have nothing to hide. In other words, once a person begins to feel guilty and condemned, the natural tendency is to, you know, go into the darkness or to hide or to cover up. And I think that when they were like little children, I think at the beginning, little children run around naked and they don't think a thing of it. I mean, they're naked, but they're not aware of it. They're certainly not ashamed, and it doesn't even cross their minds that they're naked most of the time. But they do reach an age, and it's not a very advanced age, where they suddenly realize that they're naked and don't want to really run around that way in public. They don't want people, they want to, you know, dress and undress behind closed doors and so forth. And I think that does speak of them coming to the point where they have a bit of a moral sensitivity. And not that being naked is immoral, but rather they simply become more morally sophisticated, so that, you know, more like concealment is more part of the fallen human nature. And so I don't think them putting on clothes or knowing that they were naked or being ashamed has any impact on whether they would have children or not. Because when God created them, he certainly did not command them to fall. He did not command them to eat the tree, but he did command them to have children. He commanded them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So I believe that if they had been obedient to God, then they would not have eaten of the tree, but they still would have had children.
So it was just out of respect to God, then, that is why they covered themselves, basically?
No, each other also. I think that when we feel guilty, we feel isolated, and we feel like we want to conceal, well, sometimes from God and from other people, our guilt. Certainly, I think that's what religion does with reference to our feeling of guilt toward God. When someone feels that they're not right before God, there's a strong temptation to resort to religious practices, you know, going to prayer and paying your tithes or, you know, doing some kind of a religious thing, as it were, to cover up the sense of guiltiness, more or less to counterbalance it so that my guiltiness doesn't embarrass me too much before God. But the Bible says that all things are naked and open before him with whom we have to do. So I believe that when they made fig leaves for themselves, that they were exercising the same instincts that people have when they adopt for themselves religious systems or moral systems or make resolutions to do better. because they're feeling bad about what they've done in the past, and they don't want to feel bad anymore. They want to cover that up. They want to cover up that sense of guilt by doing good deeds or religious things or whatever. I think that that's what they were doing in principle when they didn't want to be naked in front of God or in front of each other. They hid from each other as well. And you know, I think that's true, too. When we know that we have done something wrong, we really would prefer other people didn't know about it. To cover it up is our first preference. Jesus said that, you know, whoever does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be seen that they're done in God. But, you know, light comes into the world, and men love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. And whoever does evil does not come to the light, he said. That person wants to go into the darkness where his evil will not be seen. And I think we find Adam and Eve not only putting on the garments to cover the nakedness, but we see them also hiding in the bushes. You know, they put on their ghillie suits and hid in the bushes, hoping God wouldn't see them, and perhaps hoping each other wouldn't see each other, too.
So Genesis 3:7, it reads as, "And the eyes of both of them were opened, and
yes,
they knew that they were naked." But opened to what?
Well, it means they had a spiritual awakening. This is what the devil said would happen. He says, God knows that the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you'll know good and evil. And that was it. Their moral sensitivities were awakened. Say their eyes were opened as a figure of speech. Their eyes were already open. They could see before that. But what it's saying is figurative, as a figure of speech, they became for the first time aware of realities that they had not had any awareness of before. And it's like they opened their eyes for the first time to see something. And what they were seeing was their own guiltiness. And their nakedness made them embarrassed when they were guilty. It did not make them embarrassed when they were not guilty.
Okay, Steve. Thank you.
Okay, Alex. Thanks for your call. All right. We're going to talk next to Stan from Las Vegas, Nevada. Stan, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yeah, you had a caller talking about the book of Isaiah before.
Yeah.
I wonder if you or any of your callers subscribe to the view that the book of Isaiah is really a beautiful microcosm of the entire Bible from Genesis to Revelation. And that,
well, in some ways, it's been pointed out that the book of Isaiah is 66 chapters and the Bible is 66 books. And there are 39 chapters in the Old Testament. There's 39 books in the Old Testament, 39 chapters in the first section of Isaiah. There's 27 books of the New Testament. There's 27 chapters in the second part. The second part, which is comparable to the New Testament, begins with a prophecy about John the Baptist in Isaiah 40, verses 6 through 8 or so. And the New Testament begins with John the Baptist. The last part of Isaiah, the last verses, chapters, end with the description of the new heaven and the new earth, which is how the New Testament ends also. And the central chapter is Isaiah 53 of that last section. And, of course, that's the chapter that most clearly depicts Jesus. So there are many things about Isaiah that people have seen as comparable. I like those comparisons myself. I think they're very fascinating. One of the things, that weakens the case is that the chapter divisions in Isaiah are not inspired. You know, God, one could argue that the canon of Scripture was inspired or not, but the chapter divisions in Isaiah were not inspired. So the comparison of these numbers is, only a little bit arbitrary, but not entirely.
Well, you could make a mathematical case that the chances of these amazing similarities happening by chance are one in a bazillion, that even though it was happenstance that the chapters 1 through 39, you know, that they were done by man, but of course God was leading man, and supernaturally the book of Isaiah, in my opinion, and I think it's yours too, is so spectacular that it can be a microcosm of the entire Bible, and that there's a website called the Isaiah Wheel, where they've written a hardcover book, in addition to the website, that goes into this stuff amazingly with complexity that would just blow your socks off. Have you ever seen the Isaiah Wheel?
No, I have not.
Okay. Another point, The Christians believe in one Messiah with two appearances, a first coming and a second coming. Couldn't be the rabbis, as you pointed out. They just had a mirror image of it, where they had two personality types of a Messiah in one appearing, the son of Joseph and the son of David, the conquering one. And they got it reversed. They thought the conquering one would come first, and then the suffering servant would come later. It's kind of like God has a sense of humor, I guess. Do you believe in that? I mean, could you see that?
That God has a sense of humor, or that the rabbis were seeing the same things that Christians see, but giving them a different interpretation.
Oh, but they got it a mirror image of it, because they couldn't believe at the time of the Roman persecution that the Messiah would come as a suffering servant. They were all looking for the Messiah to, take care of business, wham, bam. And it didn't happen. So it's kind of like if you go to a rainforest, you're looking for rain. I mean, it's a classical tragedy, I guess, my opinion. But he is the Messiah is both the lineage of David and the lineage of Joseph, correct?
The lineage of David in the Old Testament character. Of course, Joseph was not his real father. Joseph was a stepfather. But he was son of Joseph in one sense. And son
in one
of David
sense,
in
he
the
has
other.
A strong connection to Joseph because he was his stepfather. So obviously he had a close relationship with his stepfather.
Yeah.
So this stuff is fascinating when you read the historical situation and how people could confuse things and where we stand today. But I recommend to your audience to really look into the book of Isaiah. The 39 chapters resembling the 39 books of the Old Testament. It is mathematically, statistically, supernatural. It could not have occurred it could not have occurred by chance, is what mathematicians will tell you about the amazing book of Isaiah. I think you can study the book of Isaiah for your whole life.
And what is that website you mentioned, Isaiah Wheel?
The Isaiah Wheel, Wheel.
.com.
Excuse me, it also might be under the Ezekiel wheel. I forget which one where they...
Oh.
I'm sorry, it's been a while. I have the book. I'll have to go dig it out, and maybe the next time I call, I'll give you the exact title. This hardcover book, about 400 pages with graphs, with timelines.
Okay.
It is beyond belief. So, okay, I'll dig it out and get the exact title for you next time.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay.
All right, bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Joan from Linwood, Washington, and we have lines open for you and a little time left if you want to call at 1-800-438-5090. My name is Steve Gregg. You're listening to The Narrow Path. You can call with your questions about the Bible or with your disagreements that you have with the host. Feel free to call 1-800-438-5090. Joan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
All right.
Oh, good. Listening to Bruce talk in Isaiah.
Yeah.
That subject. I really appreciated your perspective, and I just wanted to add one more thing. Was as a person who writes sometimes, varying degrees of skill.
Uh-huh.
I would say that sometimes I have a different voice when I write. It's just depending on the mood
mm-hmm.
and the subject matter, and also the degree of inspiration.
Right, that is true.
So that,
and you know, Isaiah, like I said, Isaiah's ministry extended over about 50 years, and it was about the middle of that time that he completed the writing of chapters 1 through 39, which means that for the first 25 years he wrote the first part. It could have been close to 20 years later that he wrote the second part. We don't know at what point in his life he did, because no dates are given to the later part. And therefore, he could have really improved, or he could have been in a very different state of mind while writing.
That was my thought. And then given so much time, that there's a lot of time for him to have many different voices there in his
That's
writing.
Right.
And also, he had two major themes, is what I'm seeing, is that one is more almost political and prophetic in a warning way, and then the other is a comforting way to his people.
Well, that's right. The second section is sometimes called the Book of Comfort, because it's that's what it is. It's got different emphases. Yeah.
And it's probably more of an overly simplified to say it that way, but that's always how I saw it. And then finally, I wanted to say that it's sort of, I think a lot of these times that we're trying to explain things in the natural, when really there's a supernatural, and it's supernatural that even that we have a book at all from God. It's with all the continuity, and I mean, we know it's from God. And so why wouldn't the Lord why wouldn't he change his tone with the message? So I don't think we need to have a natural explanation for the different, or just the different sound of the two parts of the book.
Well, right. The first 39 chapters are written to the nation which is under judgment because of its wickedness. And the latter part of Isaiah is written from the perspective of God comforting them after they've been through chastisement. They've been through the 70-year captivity in Babylon, and now he's telling them about how he's going to restore them back to their land and forgive them and give them a new start. So, you know, where he's talking about their judgment that they're under and his complaints about them, obviously he speaks with a different tone than when he's trying to comfort them and tell them, okay, now it's time to put all that behind you and don't think about the former things. I'm going to do a new thing now. So, I agree with you.
And the fact that it was written from a perspective of comforting, even though they hadn't even been there yet, that's easily explained by the prophetic.
Yeah, that's how I would explain it. Of course, the natural thinkers would say, well, he must have written it later after the event because he's writing as if from that perspective of a later time. But I think that's a prophetic device. Yeah.
So, that's all I had to say, and thank you.
All right, Joan, hey, are you going to be hanging around the school in Monroe this summer?
I was really wanting to. I don't know if I'll be able to or not, but I definitely on the evenings. I don't know if you're going to do an evening open to the public again.
You will have some evening classes, yeah.
Oh, great. Okay, well, I'm hoping to do that for sure. And then the other, I don't know yet.
All right. Well, God bless you.
Well, thank you, Steve. God bless you, too. Good to talk to you.
Good to hear from you. Bye now. Yeah, Joan is a lady that we met last summer when we were holding the Great Commission School in the YWAM base in Monroe. She's a local Christian there who discovered us on the radio and started coming to our public meetings we had there. For those of you who don't know about the Great Commission School, it's a program that I teach for 10 weeks in the summertime in Seattle. Now, at least 2 years in a row, it's been in the Seattle area, in Monroe, which is northeast of Seattle. But we rent the facilities that are owned by Youth with a Mission and run a school that is not actually not a Youth with a Mission school. It's really, we're just using the facilities. And students live there for 10 weeks. We have classes morning and night. It's an all-day program, a residential program. It's an intensive immersion in the Bible. And we don't cover the whole Bible in 10 weeks. We cover about 13 or 14 books of the Bible, verse by verse, and I teach them, and you can find details about that school. If that sounds interesting to you, you can find details at our website. There's a link to it. The website is thenarrowpath.com, and there's a link right there on the first page that says for information about the Great Commission School or the new Great Commission School. That link will tell you what the school's about. And one thing you'll find is that it's a very inexpensive program because no teachers are paid. I'm the only teacher, and I don't get paid. In fact, I pay to be there because we rent the facilities per person. We pay Youth with a Mission room and board for each person. And I pay for my room and board, too, because I'm not a YWAM staffer. So they are giving us such a good deal on room and board. You can find out at the website that you could hardly live anywhere else cheaper and have three meals provided in bed, and your schooling comes free with that. Anyway, that's an unusual program. It'll be happening this summer. We may be able to still accept some applicants. You'd have to get in pretty quickly, though. It's at thenarrowpath.com. You click on the link that says the new Great Commission School. Let's talk to Ricardo from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Ricardo.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I want to ask you if you have some resources or on your, or first of all, on your website that I can refer back to on some advice or some pointers on being able to approach or not approach, but talk to a Jehovah Witness. I know they have interesting beliefs, but you know, basically, if you can direct me to a good some good reliable sources that I could maybe get on online or something.
Well, at my website, of course, we have hundreds of my lectures. The interesting thing is, I don't think I've ever given a lecture specifically about the Jehovah's Witnesses. I think there's a lecture I gave once about the Mormons, but I don't have lectures I've given refuting the cults that much. Although a funny thing is, ever since I was a young guy, which was 40 years ago when I was young, I've been very interested in refuting cults. I just have not made it. It's not the focus of our school when I teach, and that's where those recordings are made to pick on the cults. But as far as specific doctrines of the Jehovah's Witnesses, some of them are refuted in my lectures there, particularly their views about Christ and the Trinity and so forth. You can find lectures of mine on that subject if you go to the website, thenarrowpath.com, and click the link that says, look for topical lectures. Okay. And you'll find that under that there's a series of lectures called Knowing God. And there's lectures there on the Trinity and on the deity of Christ. Those would be the main issues that I would mostly want to be concerned about the Jehovah's Witness on. They have other doctrines I don't agree with, but I don't think the other doctrines are anywhere near as important.
Yeah, I agree. Good. So that was all. I just wanted to see if something I can, better prepare myself. You know, it's a couple that I've met in the last month, and we've just been interacting, and I just basically just trying to extend friendship. But it's just interesting how on their initial approach, without even getting to know me, you know, it's already on the defensive, and I just out of respect, and love, listen to them, but. They pitched the idea of picking a topic and having a debate or an argument.
Really? So, really? That's interesting. Yeah. Now, did they do that because they knew you were a Christian prepared to defend your views? I mean, they don't usually just come up to strangers and say you want to fight.
Yeah. Well, I'm a small business owner, and one of my businesses that I do is I do preliminary work for a network company. And so when they approached me, they were inviting me to for the Easter weekend something. I told them, that this guy that approached me, he was a sharp looking, guy, and I told him I wasn't able to because I'm going to be participating in a play on Sunday. But thanks, and I just turned it around and turned it into business, and I said, you look like a sharp guy. How about we just exchange phone numbers? So that led to this. We sat down, talked about business, and then, little did I know he was Jehovah's Witness. Well, I mean, I did whenever he gave me the flyer, but my intention wasn't to, talk about, religion or anything. But he approached me, and I'm passionate about the Lord. But now when he approached me, I just saw the importance to really be able to sit down without having to be on the defensive and actually share the word, but, in a teaching way. And so I'm just kind of curious to be able to sit down and do that. I've never put myself in a situation because I just know the what they're known for, the reputation, things they believe like blood transfusion and about hell and all this other stuff. So they said pick a question, and I text them the question. I said, well, let's we have an hour. You will have 30 minutes, and I'll have 30 minutes, and let's talk about who Jesus Christ is. So I wanted some resources. So that's how it happened.
Yeah, who Jesus Christ is really the main issue to discuss with them. I don't agree with them about the blood transfusions, but it's not the kind of issue that I would make a focal point. Their views about hell, I probably hold a different view than they do, but I don't have a I'm not worried about their view. You know, I'm not really alarmed by people holding different views of hell. There are several different views out there, even that Christians hold. So,
yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Do you have something here on your website on hell or?
Yes. Actually, there's a couple lectures called Three Views of Hell. Now, I don't know. Yeah, three views of hell.
Oh, three
and
views.
Three, yeah, like the number three. And I actually don't know if those lectures are currently on our new website, because we just put up a new website. Those lectures were actually not there on our old website, I think, but they are on another site. In any case, you can definitely find them at digitalministries.us.
digitalministries.us,
and if you just follow the links to my name, you'll find that there's a two-part lecture series called Three Views of Hell, which you may find interesting.
Okay. Well, thanks, Steve, and I appreciate
okay,
you taking
Ricardo.
The call.
Thanks for calling.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, and we're just about out of time here. I guess we really don't have time to take any more calls. I have received a question from Mark by way of email, and he says, I often hear people say that Jesus suffered so we don't have to. Is that true? Well, it sounds like maybe the people you've been hearing from might have been of the Word of Faith persuasion, because they say that Jesus bore our sicknesses and that we therefore don't have to bear any sicknesses. We shouldn't be sick because Jesus bore our sicknesses for us. That's a view that the Word of Faith holds. I don't know if any other groups would be saying Jesus suffered so we don't have to, but that may be what you've heard. It's not quite correct. It is true that Jesus bore our sicknesses in a sense, but the way the Bible understands that, and it quotes that verse from Isaiah 53 that says he bore our sicknesses. It quotes it in Matthew 8:17, I believe it is, if I'm not mistaken. And it says that Jesus fulfilled that when he was healing people. He didn't he didn't bear our sicknesses all at once. He bore sicknesses one at a time on individuals. He didn't heal everybody, but he healed some people, and in doing so, he was bearing from them, lifting from them their sicknesses. But to say Jesus suffered so that we wouldn't have to suffer is actually the opposite of what the Bible says. It says in 1 Peter chapter 2, it says in verse 20, what glory is it if when you're buffeted for your faults, you take it patiently? But if when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God, for God has called you to this, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps. In other words, Jesus suffered for us not so that we wouldn't suffer, but he suffered for us to leave us an example of suffering for righteousness' sake, so we would follow his example of suffering. So, I think that those who say Jesus suffered so we don't have to, it's wishful thinking on their part, and it certainly doesn't resemble what the Bible teaches, as near as I can understand it. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're daily on this program, same time of day, Monday through Friday. We are a listener-supported ministry. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air, if you find some benefit in the program and think others do too, you may want to help us pay the radio bills, because we have to buy the time on the radio. The you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow so we can continue our discussion. God bless.